Welcome to Brains, a podcast exploring the inner workings of our brains, mental health, and disabilities, and how film and television portray them. Hosted by me, film and television editor, Sarah Taylor.
And by me, writer-director, Heather Taylor. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast and from where you are listening are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples. And we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us and encourage you to do the same.
Today, we get to talk to fellow sister pair, Kat and Nico Trubetskoy, who are the co-creators of the new CW and CTV show, Sight Unseen. The series is about a homicide detective who rapidly loses her vision and has to quit the homicide force. When she leaves, she's haunted by the cases she's left behind and is determined to solve them with the help of her visual guide via a visual assistance app.
In this episode of Brains, we discuss sight loss, the representation of vision loss and blindness on Sight Unseen, and what considerations had to be made when creating a television show for viewers across the entire vision spectrum.
A quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice, and it is for informational purposes only. Because everyone's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions.
Thank you so much, Nico and Kat, for coming and joining us today on Brains.
We're really happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
You're sisters. I want to say that off the hop, which I'm very excited about. Talking to another pair of sisters. This is great. So yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
We're actually half sisters. So we have the same dad and different moms. And we grew up separately, just kind of seeing each other on family vacations. So I think that's probably the key to us being able to work together and not kill each other, at least so far. Kat started off in the industry as a writer, producer, working with the networks, and I'm a little bit younger, and I've always written, and I was a poet. And then she, at one point in my career, as I was trying desperately to get poems published for like $50, she and her partner, Derek, had a show going, and they were like, hey, do you want to come be a script coordinator, and you can see other people and actually make money? And I did that for a season, and it was wonderful. Like, the making money was good, but the part that really got me into the industry was being able to write and being able to also talk to other human beings at the same time. I think being by myself alone in a room was maybe not mentally the healthiest place for me to be. And so, yeah, she suckered me into this industry. And after that, I went to film school and started working as a writer sort of independently of her. What shows have we crossed over on, Kat? We worked together on a couple of shows.
The weird thing is we both worked on this sci-fi show, Orphan Black, which is quite well known. But we worked on it in separate seasons. It was just a coincidence. I did all the sci-fi phenomena, Killjoys, on Sci-Fi Network.
Oh, I love Killjoy.
Oh, that's so good.
That's so good, yeah.
I think it's now built a following, but, you know, sometimes it's like someone drops a rock in a pond and the ripples aren't heard for a long time, but it's a great little show. And I did all 50 episodes, executive produced them, and the creator, Michelle Lavretta, invited Nico on to be in the writer's room for the last 30 episodes. And that is the first time we really worked together, where she was writing, I was executive producing, and it was a big team, but we got along fine through it. So then we started developing a few things together as an experiment, and we are very different. It's like the Venn diagram everyone's very into right now. We have a little overlap in our personal experiences, but we are super opposites on a bunch of creative levels. And together, creating a story or creating a pilot, we have a really good push and pull, and we actually fight, which is good, and argue, but also admire the other part that the sister brings, like, because it's so different. And so that's how we started a few projects together.
One of the ground rules that we laid down was that we could only work on projects together if we were both equally passionate about them, because otherwise we felt like it would negatively impact our relationship with each other. And yeah, we did a few things. And then Sight Unseen, we're just lucky enough that it was the right project at the right time and got snatched up by Bell and then sold it to CW. And it was a really, really good experience working together through it. As Kat said, we both brought very different strengths to the project, which I think was really helpful.
Can you tell us about Sight Unseen and maybe the genesis of the idea, and then kind of how did you get it now to screens, to Bell, to CW? Like, how is it on our televisions today?
In a nutshell, Sight Unseen is about a homicide detective who rapidly loses her vision, and she has something called Elron, L. Leber's hereditary neuropathy. So she very rapidly loses her vision and has to quit the homicide force. She loses her vision during a case. She has open cases. And when she leaves, she's haunted by the cases she's left behind and is determined not to leave them abandoned, but solve them. And in particular, in the pilot, there's a seminal moment where it is her fault. Like, she should have come clean. She didn't. And a suspect gets away. So that haunts her. She doesn't want to face her sight loss head on. She finds a workaround, very common. There are apps for people who are blind or sight impaired that allow them to connect to someone who sees for them, whether it's through their cell phone and they just use their phone camera very commonly, or if you're a blind professional, you just get a camera and clip it and an earpiece. And you can walk around as though you were sighted with someone informing you of everything that's happening and when and guiding you. That is the whole series. So it's about the detective who continues solving crime and the woman who guides her in her ear, who has her own issues and a hidden agenda of her own. And all that together makes it a bit of a detective thriller. There's a little bit of a psychological element to it because we're never quite sure if we can trust the guide completely, but we love her. She's lovable. So it's like that complicated emotion you get when you just love a character and she's lovable, but she's got agoraphobia. She never leaves her house and she is using the detective as a way to get out, as an avatar. So she's getting out in the world and more.
What was the passion that you both shared that made this be the one that you wanted to do together?
Sight loss is something that is in our family and something Kat has experienced. So that area is something that has always been on both of our minds. And so we were both at home and we're each listening to a podcast where we heard about an app called Aira. And Aira is one of these apps that people who have sight loss use to as a guiding app. It's a professional app that is paid for. And it was a podcast about somebody who was blind and described themselves as blind, showing us as we listen to how she uses this app. So as you're listening, you hear her getting ready to go to this podcast. So she gets dressed, you hear the guide guiding her in terms of what she's wearing, you hear the guide guiding her out of her apartment, down the stairs, into the front of her house, getting into an Uber. And then you hear the guiding experience as she gets out at the building where the studio is and gets into an elevator to go up to the podcast studio. And there was this moment in the elevator where the woman with sight loss looks in a mirror and all of a sudden the guide is like, oh my God, I see you. Like she had this moment where she saw her in that moment. It was just like such an interesting, unique relationship. You were like hearing the two voices talking to each other. And then, you know, the woman with sight loss talked about her experience and how she used the app and stuff. And Kat and I started texting each other almost instantaneously at the same time with the, oh my God, isn't this the ultimate detective show? You know, to have somebody solving crime with another person in their ear who has a different opinion, who is guiding them around, who is bringing a totally different, unique, unprofessional in a way, but also like a completely new perspective to solving crime. And it seemed like the perfect idea for a detective show.
And the mirror moment was very meta because it reminded us, we were listening, right? We weren't seeing it. So when she talked about seeing her client in the mirror, we realized it really hit home that the guide is looking out. The guide is the eyes. So this person in their home, wherever they may be remotely, are only seeing the perspective of the sight impaired person. They're not seeing that person. And so that moment was very kind of meta and drew us in and made us realize that this is two different perspectives visually, not just two different concepts of the world, but two different visual perspectives in a very literal sense, which is fascinating. And then the other element is that I'm one who has suffered from periodic sight loss and profound sight loss, but only short times. And I can explain that this started with a very sudden event in my early 20s. And I was out partying, slam dancing, and drinking, and maybe doing some drugs. That was way back. And I woke up the next morning and half my vision was just black. And I could still see out of part of my eyes. And I really thought it was an epic hangover of some kind that I hadn't experienced before. And I called someone and they said, you need to just go to an eye doctor in case. Like, I'm sure they were thinking brain tumor or something. And so I went immediately to an eye doctor and the eye doctor said, don't move. I'm calling the hospital. Which for a very hungover 20-something is like, what? I just have a problem with my eye. Why are you telling me not to move? Like, it was like, and he had opened his office for me and stuff. So I was all alone. He's telling me to sit in the chair and don't move. He came back in and said, you're not taking this very seriously. Stop moving. I didn't know about retinal detachments. I didn't understand. He said he had called emergency and they were standing by and that I was going to need an operation. And he didn't know this at the time. But when I got to emergency, they had a trolley out in the emergency entryway and they'd literally lay me back on it on what felt like an operating table. And I was just like, what the hell is going on? My family, what? A doctor came, looked in my eyes and he says, you need an operation on both your eyes right away. Your retinas, it's not just one, both of them are detaching. And so they whisked me and they did a big surgery and I woke up unable to see, completely covered. And then one very important thing that we say about sight unseen and about sight impairment is most people can see something I can see now, but most people see who are even identify as blind, but retinal detachment is blackness. But they did manage to put both back. I have a silicone band around one eye, which is called a sclerobuckle, and I had cryotherapy in the other, which is quite a, like my face was swollen up like Rocky Balboa after the biggest fight. And I couldn't see, I guess, severe sight impairment. Some people would call it blindness for like weeks, but it slowly came back. They repaired me so I can see, but that's always haunted me. The fears I had at that time were like fears of a young 20-something year old, not being able to see the face of my loved ones. And significantly for me, which I tried hard to get us to put in the pilot, I also was horrified to never be able to see my own face again. And the doctors were not able to tell me it would be successful, but it was. And so since then, I've had countless laser surgeries. They always managed to staple the retinas back. And I had a more invasive surgery to get a new lens in my left eye. And then during the shoot of Sight Unseen, this is, again, not weird, but everyone thought it was coincidence. I started not being able to see. And one of our consultants on set, I was just not being able to see is a myriad of things, right? So people really think this is a binary thing. No, it's like one eye was clouded. The other one had some sort of opaqueness over it. I still like was like, I can see. I'm just having trouble seeing my scripts, but I just get closer. I just magnify them. It was thing after thing tripping around. Amy, one of our on-set consultants who uses a cane, is saying to me, but it's okay. You probably have scar tissue, you know, that builds up after that much laser surgery. And I was in denial, but I went to see a doctor. Short story. Yes, she went around like some sort of Star Trek person with lasers and lasered all that scar tissue out. And then I could see. And now I'm overdue for a new lens in my right eye. And that's the whole sight loss story for me. And like many people, periods of not seeing well, mostly being able to see very well.
So I was born with congenital cataracts. And watching the show is like, I never really thought about how much like fear I have about losing my vision. I don't know why I'm laughing, but like I had to have my left eye cataract removed, a new lens put in, and then had to go back and get the laser exactly how you described. But I was like, no, I'm fine. I can still see. It's fine. And yes. It took me. And then finally, the eye doctor was like, holy crap, there's a lot of scar tissue back there. You need to go get a surgery. I was like, what are you talking? No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. So I can really relate to your journey. And also, yeah, anyway, the fear of like not being able to see.
For everyone listening, because they may think they'll never have this, but as you get older, these things happen. This laser surgery where they're going around like some sci-fi show, zapping the lasers and following the freaking broken asteroids.
Catching it. Yeah, totally.
It's nothing. My assistant went and it was a teaching hospital. They let her look through the other lens. She's like, oh my God. Oh my God. It's like a video game. But for the person experiencing it, it's literally not that big a deal.
No.
And you can see, at least it wasn't for me. I shouldn't speak for you.
No, it wasn't. No.
But you can see quite soon after, it's like, oh.
Yeah, I didn't realize how bad, like my vision's not great in that eye anyway, but I didn't realize how bad having that scar tissue was making it even harder. And like why I was like, my eyes were always sore. Anyway, it was a whole thing, but you don't know until it's gone. And then you're like, oh, wow.
What's fascinating is that what you're telling us, as we have talked about the show with cast and crew and pitching it to people as we were hiring people through the production process, that story is something that we heard from so many different people. Like it's so much more common than what we normally think of as blindness, you know, from a traditional TV media sort of perspective, as a complete loss of sight. But this spectrum that we all seem to exist on was something that we heard like from a lot of different people over the process of making Sight Unseen.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. This is why it's important to make shows like this. So thank you.
But even talking to you about your sight loss issues, I'd never talked to anyone who had the laser for the scar tissue. You are the first person I've talked to who's had that experience. So that is not common.
So I had my cataract removed a little less than 20 years ago. So it was a long time ago. And then I had the surgery about 3 years ago with the laser. The ophthalmologist that did this, or the eye surgeon, was like, I normally don't see my patients twice. I don't have to do this surgery on typical cataract patients, because you get your cataract removed when you're in your like 70s, and then you don't have to come back to get the scar tissue removed, which is really morbid, but like,
oh my God.
But it's just fascinating that we've had that experience.
Why was it important for you to have a character on screen who's clinically blind? And, you know, what did you do differently with this portrayal from what you've maybe seen on screen before?
The story was organically about somebody with sight loss, and we were really fascinated by it because we really wanted to portray what a spectrum vision lies across, and how, you know, even with people who can see quote unquote normally, it still exists on a spectrum, and with sight loss very much so. And there are so many different ways of seeing, and how seeing really, especially from the law and order perspective, how you see and what you see really influences how you perceive other people, how you judge other people, the way you solve crime. So one of the things that we were really fascinated with in terms of having a story about a detective who became clinically blind was how that would change her perspective on her job and the way she did her job and the way she approached suspects and victims and crime solving, and how much sight actually influences that, your impression of a person, your impression of a crime scene. So that was a really fascinating aspect of the story to us. And we've obviously watched a lot of shows and movies about sight loss. It is a little disappointing to me that sight loss is usually portrayed as a black and white thing. I think most of the characters that we see in the media who experience sight loss, it's like you can see or you're blind. And there's not really, we don't show that spectrum that it exists on. And almost never, I mean, at least I can't think of an example where we're seeing what the person with sight impairment is seeing. So you're never taking the audience into that perspective.
No. And it, so therefore you're watching someone perform blindness in a black box way. Like you don't see what they're experiencing. You just see how they move.
Yes.
That's very distancing. I don't like the word othering, but you certainly see them as other when you never experience what they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And they do portrayals by actors who don't have any sight impairment or sight loss story or familiarity with family. They do kind of mime sight loss in a larger way, I think, sometimes. It's tempting. And one of the biggest differences that we found with all the sight impaired people and people who identify as blind is even people with almost a blackout total blindness, they look at you. They can look you in the eye. They don't particularly appear blind. They're not staring off. Like, especially, and this is what we are portraying, someone who has grown up with sight and then lost it.
Right.
So if you're an adult with sight loss, you generally look like you do not have sight loss. Mm-hmm. And that's controversial to the sighted public. Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard stories about people who use a cane who actually, if they reach for something and get it or see a car in front of them, it's like people are like, why are you using a cane? Why are you faking it? Like they get stigmatized. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For not being blind enough for the able-bodied people of the world.
Yeah.
So that's all interesting.
Dolly Lewis, who plays Tess, our lead, has a different experience with sight loss than the character has, but it was really important to us that we cast somebody who did have experience with sight loss so that they could bring that to it. Mm-hmm. She is performing because Tess's sight is different than her sight, but she is also bringing her own experience with sight loss to the role. And I think that makes a really big difference in how that is performed.
A lot of people who had sight loss from birth were also auditioning, and it's just very different. Our character had to have that deep-seated knowledge of crime solving. She had to be the top of her field or this would be far-fetched. And then the other thing about sight and crime solving that people who are like, oh, this is far-fetched, don't think of. If you can walk into a crime scene and solve it with your eyes, and that is true, in fact, probably of the majority of crimes, it's generally just one of those crimes of passion where, you know, someone shot someone, that body's lying there, there's footsteps. Like, if you can solve it with your eyes, it's not a big case. It's actually about digging under, finding the motivations, finding why and who might have hidden something. The first thing a criminal does or a murderer does, depending on the crime, is hide the visual evidence.
Yes.
So the eyes are not really relevant in this world of science and forensic science. She's a puzzle master, and that's, you don't need your eyes to be a puzzle master. You need forensic backing and understanding people and motives.
I'm curious, how did you come up with the visual representation of Tess's vision?
Tess's blind POV was something that we worked on with our producing director, John Fawcett, and our cinematographer, Michael Marshall. And it was, we really wanted to do something in camera so that it would feel immediate and visceral to the audience rather than something in post. Mm-hmm. And we also wanted it to be beautiful as well, you know, like we wanted it to be both beautiful and thrilling and terrifying at moments. And so we looked at different conditions that are out there in terms of what people see, what people don't see. And then we looked at a variety of in-camera effects and kind of, it's a bit of a mishmash. Like it doesn't totally mimic what somebody with Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy would experience, but we wanted to give the sighted audience the feeling of what it would be like to be on the visual spectrum of sight loss. So I think it probably technically mirrors what Kat experiences a little bit more, which is retinal detachment.
Well, yes, but actually, just to be specific, retinal tugs that cause that visual, it tends to be a jagged light, but you've had floaters that are bright and light shining and all that. So it's a little bit drawn from that. And I think what people don't understand too with different kinds of sight eye conditions is you can have several things going on at once.
Yeah.
Like a lot of floaters. I've had my vitreous fluid taken out, replaced. Like, so floaters, sort of like, what's that beautiful Stranger Things when they have all those floating things and Stranger Things?
In the upside down world.
Yeah, the upside down world. We talked about that for a while, but then we thought, yeah, that's going to be really distracting for the audience.
I just love that you're doing it in camera as well, because you're right. Like, it does make it feel more real and less like just put on. So just yay. Thank you for doing that.
And I want to know, like, did you show Dolly the look of it before she started? Like, that was like part of the process.
Yeah.
She's very subtle. You can kind of see her touch the wall. Like, but you wouldn't know unless you're looking for the cues that she is not sighted. So it's great.
And a spoiler alert of sorts is that, and it's present in the show, but very subtly, we are having her sight loss progress and change a little bit. So it does get a little bit worse, and it can change in different ways, but also because it, and I love that you like that it's an in-camera effect. We tried not to use visual effects, but I wasn't sure anyone would appreciate that. So I'm like delighted.
Oh, totally. It's amazing.
It's my heart. It's my heart.
What's interesting though, because it's an in-camera effect, different light totally affects it differently. And I wonder if audiences are going to go, we haven't heard any comments like this yet, but how come her vision's not exactly the same? Well, in bright light, it kind of dazzles up. And in low light, it seems more like, you know, a veil. It changes in different lights, which is true of sight impairment.
On the flip side of Sunny, so we see how she sees things too, because she is coming in as a camera, essentially, and seeing kind of what Tess can see, but in a different way. How did you come up with that perspective? And also, you know, you have a character who has agoraphobia, which is interesting for us. Our mom has agoraphobia. So
the show is like really
the show
for
is
us.
Like, thanks My for making God. The show for us.
Karen does not like leaving the house because she likes to control her environment.
That's the ticket to agoraphobia.
This sort of came up for two reasons. One is, this is a little dark and triggering, but I have had violent experience. Home invasion, it did create, I guess now in retrospect, and not completely ever over, deep-seated PTSD, which made me not able to sleep at night and barricading. And I would barricade and then barricade in a barricade. And this is not something I've talked about to people. So anyone listening who knows me, some people know about this. And the very bad times, I would use ropes to tie doors shut, travel with stuff to block hotel rooms. That's something that's really alive mentally for me. And the new part that you've just added is, and Nico, I guess new because she said it, is it's about control. Yeah. So that's fascinating. And I should look into that because, yeah, I am really freaking controlling. And that is what is a challenge probably for Nico working with me. But practically speaking, this person we knew would be a guide and could do it from anywhere. And so practically speaking, we were fascinated at someone who could live all these lives vicariously. And our big central question for Sunny was, why does she do this for a living?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why does it matter when she runs into Tess that this is the person she gloms onto? She's working for a company, doing this for a living. As soon as she finds out Tess is a homicide detective, she's kind of in like Flynn, like, hi, it's me again. Oops, I called your landline or I called your home phone. What is it? Something had to have happened in her past. And whatever that is, it makes sense logically that it would be violent and that it would be what drove her inside and what made her want to do a job where she could get out vicariously. So those are the reasons. Yeah. It fits the job.
We're also developing it right after the pandemic. And I think everybody really universally had this experience where we were all kind of confronting whether we like being in our homes, whether we don't like being in our homes, whether we like seeing other people, whether we don't, you know, like it was something that I think was a really universal experience for everybody coming out of those times.
I think there's a lot of elements, like, because we grew up with someone who lives with agoraphobia, our mom was very successful and made sure that she had, like, she could do all the things that we needed. Like, she ran a business in our house and, like, which is similar to, like, getting a job where you can stay at home and do those things. And, like, Sunny going through and living through what she's seen in her job, you know, like, watching travel documentaries and, like, things about the world. And my mom would travel the world by watching TV. And so it's not far-fetched what you've made, like, what you the character you've created. Like, these are things that I've seen our mom do to feel like she is getting to see the world, to do be part of the world without leaving her safety parameters that she's created to, you know, the control she's created. But that's just to feel safe. That's what it's about.
Yeah, the idea that the spaces become smaller because when you go to, let's say, the bank and you have a panic attack, you're like, well, if I don't go to the bank, I won't have a panic attack again, so I won't go to the bank anymore. And so slowly your world becomes smaller, or like, I'm going to be the movie theater, but I have to only sit on the aisle just in case something happens. So it's like, you can have agoraphobia and leave the house, but it depends on your trigger, right, to make you stay home.
Yes.
And so it's like, I think a lot of times that isn't as explored as much because not as many people know someone who has agoraphobia, but the feelings of it, for sure, I think there's that experience. So I think that's what's really interesting about Sunny being in the world and being in the world of Tess. And I know it's a detective thriller, there is obviously another meaning for it, but it's lovely to see, like, yeah, that is something that people have craved and do crave in their life, about being with other people, but not being with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say that Nico and I are most fascinated by Sunny.
Definitely.
But, and just being really honest, we didn't do a ton of research on agoraphobia. And one of the reasons was I felt like she was marginal, like me. It's just like, people don't go, I have it. Although she does, because we had to explain, she had to explain herself to Tess, who got angry. But it is always like, I'm fine, just like the sight impairment, I'm fine. And yet both these women need each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful. Like, the networks were very into that beautiful empowerment, but we were very into, and both these women are using each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the flip side, which is also fascinating. And, and just like pure practicality, I just like to say this because it's prosaic and it's not any brainiac thing, but it was important that whoever was getting vested in solving these homicides and caring about Tess genuinely and didn't just get on a plane and go help her, because we knew we were going to get Tess into some really dangerous places and some longer term danger places, where the logical thing would be, this woman can't see and we can't connect, whatever it is, it would be that the woman would get on the plane and fly to her. So that was also fun. And then you asked a question about Sunny's point of view through the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was just so much fun, although very hard to do because you have a tight budget. But we wanted to throw the viewer completely in, which we don't always do. So it's full screen immersion. And there was something about that that was a little effed up, because it's kind of like a video game, and the perspective in video games is called, sorry, but first person shooter. That is what they call it. But it's immersive and it's terrifying. And what's amazing about it is what's so scary, and what we tried to do with the pilot on the rooftop, is Sunny sees for her, but just like this, she can't see what's right there. She can't see that mess over there.
Yeah.
But there can be a guy with a gun not making any noise right there.
Yeah.
And Sunny can't necessarily see it. So it's really about perspective in a kind of boxed and terrifying way.
Yeah. In a way, Sunny's seeing for Tess and seeing the terror of those moments through Sunny as she's watching. I think because as viewers, you know, we watch so much TV and we are thrown into so many different scary situations that in a way we have become kind of numb to it. Like something has to be really spectacular on screen to get that sort of, oh my God. But watching somebody else's terror as they guide somebody through an unknown situation that they don't have a full viewpoint of is more thrilling for an audience and feels fresher for an audience than the first person view of what's happening.
Totally. Yeah.
For us, it's about, in a way, voyeurism, but in a way, the shot, which I am going to replicate now, that is our favorite shot. Tess can't see. She's not necessarily reacting to these situations, but it's basically Sunny, like, they just on her bed, curled up, going, oh my God, because she's there and trying to save her friend, and yet she's in bed and she spilled her popcorn. it's the point of view of the viewer, but you freaking, someone's life is on the line and in your hands.
And you're responsible.
It's also economical too.
Like, you don't have to show all
the
scary
stuff. It allows
us
to do more than we can afford to do on screen otherwise.
That's what we thought when we sold it and told the producers it would be easy. But then you really realize the implications of having a show starring two people who are never in the same room or in the same space together. And it starts to add up because double shooting. And then our insistence on showing the point of view of each of those people, literally throwing the viewers into the point of view of our protagonist and what she can and can't see, and also the camera that our co-lead uses. So all of that made triple shooting.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And what goes first? What do you get cut when your day is going long? You got to cut something. You can't cut story because it's a mystery. That camera setup is gone. There is a couple of spots we had to use, I think twice in the show, we had to use visual effects for Tess's POV, cobbled out of Sunny's camera. We tried to make just a couple of times, and that was just necessary. And Nico's giving me a dirty look, but it was only twice in 10 episodes.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad.
That's not bad at all.
That's our dirty secret. That happened twice.
It's okay, Nico. It's okay.
It's not. They're not our crowning moments of glory. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. One of our writers said in screen direction, Tess is running through all these narrow corridors with things falling. And the screen directions read, as Sunny tries to guide, it's like trying to guide a racehorse through a straw. Like basically Sunny is seeing this little thing and trying to guide Tess, who's going so fast.
That's a really good description.
I like that.
Yeah.
So I just want to go a little to like the idea of the stigmas of vision loss and sight loss. Sarah pulled this out. There's a scene in episode 4 where Tess gets to come back to the police force, but is told she'll be segregated. And like, did this stem from a lived experience? Sarah felt really enraged. So we like wanted to call that out.
You know, but, I was like, she can't go to the basement. This is ridiculous. I'm so mad.
What are some of these stigmas and how are you challenging them in your show?
We worked with like a number of different consultants who had sight loss, and we had writers in our room who had sight loss as well. And one thing that they talked about a lot was, especially like 10 to 20 years ago, the kind of training and the kind of assistance that would be available for people who have sight loss, how limiting it would be, and how it kind of just tries to slot you into what sighted people think is an appropriate job for a blind person, and how even now, one of the writers in the room, Ryan Knighton, describes himself as blind and is a bit older, lost his sight when he was a teenager. And so he had experiences of going through some of those training programs and being advised on career choices and it all being very stigmatizing and stereotypical. And then another one of our writers, Graham Isidore, is much younger and at the very beginning of his experience with sight loss. So he has some sight, but it's gradually degenerating. And he had different, but also interesting experiences of working in corporations. And he's written about this in an article in the Toronto Life, and having corporations say that they would make accessibility an option so that he could do his job, and then not having that be even be workable at all, like the provisions put in place for him not adequate at all to allow him to continue to work normally. So hearing both of those experiences really informs that moment for us.
Also really on point and only discovered partway through our writing, we had a consultant who cannot be named from the police force who introduced Dolly to an investigator who lost his vision and in fact has had to fight, has been able to retain his job in a different investigative department. So he's still an investigator of something different. I don't think he's segregated. He's in a department that's not. And when we said separated, we just meant like they would want her to in a section with the ramps and the tools. And then she makes her impassioned speech and who knows what'll happen. She might have the best of both worlds.
Dun, dun, dun. You touched on how you didn't really see many other good representations of vision loss in film and television, but what would you like to see represented more? Like you're doing stuff, but what else would you like to see out there?
Well, something we weren't able to do in first season, we would love to see some people with lifelong vision loss in jobs, in the show, living their best life. And we're touching on this with the character of Mia, who is blind, played by someone who is severely sight impaired with ocular albinism. She's from England, Northern England, amazing advocate. Her name is Alice Christina Corrigan. Fascinating human being, stunningly beautiful, incredibly nerdy. She's going places.
She auditioned for Tess originally, and then she was not right for the role of Tess, but we were like, oh my God, we have to find a way to cast this woman. She's fantastic.
But she works in our show as a disability advocate and peer mentor, but we want to see someone who just has, you know, a Joe job or whatever, who has sight impairment and other disabilities. You know, that's what we'd love to see more of. And England does it, the UK does it very well. Mm-hmm. You look at UK shows, they have physical diversity mm-hmm. everywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the shows are more interesting for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. And I think there's more and more representations of disability in general on screen in North America as well that feel like the disability isn't the main point of the role, but just a feature of the character's life. I haven't so much seen that with sight yet, but I'm sure it'll happen because it's happening everywhere else on the spectrum of disability.
I feel heartened. Is that right? I feel just happy that we are seeing more representation. I identify someone with disability and being able to see more exploration of that if characters coming from it from different perspectives. And I think it's really important. So yes, I agree. Like, I think it's getting there and it just needs to continue. And I love that you not only had people coming in to consult, but were writers and also the actors. And like, you really were mindful of that, which I think is important. And I think necessary. I think the whole phrase not about us without us is very important. And so I'm really glad that you took that to heart.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
What resources do you recommend for listeners if they want to know more about vision loss? Like, what are things that you use to research? What are some things that you looked at maybe when you were looking at your own vision loss, Kat? Like, what are some things that maybe people can take a look at?
I will just say our first and primary resource was people with vision loss, different kinds, because their experiences are so different. And if you look at any kind of textbook or online help, it's going to kind of have to be open to a lot of experiences, whereas we're creating an individual character.
I agree. I mean, I think you can just use Google and find all kinds of technical information about all the different conditions and forms of sight loss that are out there. But the thing that was most informative was hearing other people's experiences and the impact that it has on their lives. So another thing that really, I think, inspired us and informed us was one of the writers in our room, Ryan Knighton, is also a novelist as well as a very accomplished screenwriter. And his first book, Cockeyed, is just a fabulous read. And it takes you through his experiences of sight loss from which happened when he was a teenager and growing up in BC and starting to lose his sight and all the way up until meeting his wife. And you're just with him as he, it's funny. It's a really raw tale of what it's like to live that experience. Everyone should read it.
It's like a little bit like J.D. Salinger meets, you know, he's on This American Life lots of times. He's a great speaker.
He did a podcast on This American Life about getting lost in his own hotel room, which is...
That's really good. It's so good.
And he's working, I mean, he's worked on like Billions and a ton of other big American shows.
He's on a big one right now you guys are going to love, but it is right up your alley.
It's called Dr. Wolf. I think it's been announced. It sounds like it's going to be fascinating. And then also there's just like endless interesting podcasts out there. Like there's another podcast on Invisibilia on NPR that is about this man called Daniel Kish, who is blind from birth and has learned to echolocate his way around the world. And he has taught whole bunch of children who have been born with sight loss to navigate their surroundings through echolocation. And it gets right into, I guess, like the social ideas that we have about how people with sight loss should act and the way that they should find their way around the world and the way that they should behave. And he has like this totally, completely radical, different way of making his way around the world that is incredibly freeing for some people and also incredibly threatening for others. Like, it's just fascinating to hear the reaction towards that, which they really get into on Invisibilia.
I feel like maybe I've been really interested in the sight spectrum for a while because I'm like, I've listened to all these things you're talking about. Something I need to investigate.
You guys haven't asked us what the meaning of sight unseen, the title is.
Oh, yes. Tell us, please.
It's both obscure, but has so many meanings. First of all, people with diversity, whether it's neurodiverse like Sunny or people who are sight impaired do walk among us sight unseen. These are invisible disabilities. So that is one thing. The other thing is Sunny is actually with Tess sight unseen and is along for the ride in solving the crimes. I think those are the two main things. Like, we're always finding new things that...
Tess is solving crimes sight unseen, you know, using her other senses, which is bringing a whole new element to crime solving for her.
Yeah, it's all these layers to it.
Where can people find you online to follow along with your, you know, TV making, filmmaking careers?
I am on Instagram at Nicolina, which is N-I-K-O-L-I-J-N-E, which is my name.
And I'm at kat.trubetskoy, the last name being T-R-O-U-B-E-T-Z-K-O-Y. And Kat is spelled K-A-T, which is my initials. So kat.trubetskoy.
And you have your show, obviously, Sight Unseen. Where can people watch it?
It's being broadcast on CTV in Canada, Monday nights at 10 p.m. We're just coming up on the last episode, so you can catch it afterwards on ctv.ca or the CTV app. And it'll be broadcast on the CW in the States starting April 3rd at 9 p.m. on Mondays, Fridays, and Wednesday.
And also streaming in Canada only on Crave.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
Congratulations. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. That was fun.
Lovely to talk to you.
Yes, this has been a blast.
Thank you so much. That was so nice to talk to other sisters who are also in this business.
Yeah, it was.
Isn't that cool?
I was like... And we had so many things in common. I was like, what is happening?
We're the same.
It was great. And I realized during the conversation how much I actually like really relate, took from the show about vision. I was like, I think this show like unopened things that I didn't know I was concerned about. And this is really cool.
It was interesting because we did talk about this many years ago. So when you were in college and you did, I remember having to, I was helping you write something and you're writing about your vision and like, and we talked about the irony of you going into something where you were like, oh, I went into a job that I use my vision so much with.
I'm scared to lose it.
We haven't talked about that in a very long time. So I wonder if you just kind of like,
I'm going to put
that,
away.
Aside.
Well, you know, but lately I have been thinking about it because I've been developing an idea for a Fantasia documentary. And so I've been thinking about mind's eye blindness. And then I'm like, work in a visual career. And I rely on my visual, like my actual eyes seeing. And then like, what if that goes away? And then I don't have a mind's eye to conjure up things. And so like the idea of losing my sight has just been more in the front of my mind than maybe in the past. Like, yeah, I remember talking to you about it back in the day. But also what was interesting about this episode was the idea of vision spectrum. I never thought about it like that before either. And so like, you know, maybe one day I might lose, and I've already noticed my vision's changing just because as you age, your vision changes, and it might not completely be darkness. And I never thought about it that way. I always thought about like, if you're blind, it's darkness. And so that was a really interesting thing to like realize.
Yeah. And to have that conversation. It's really interesting when you have like a switch in your mind about something that you thought was something else. Mm-hmm. So love to talk always about therapy. I was talking to my therapist today. I said to her, how do you transition out of a transition? Mm-hmm. So it's already hard. You have to put transition time in, especially hard for, I think adding ADHD in the mix makes it even more fun. Mm-hmm. I'll say fun, challenging. Spicy. And she said, well, what is the feeling you get right before you start something? And I said, like impatience, like that feeling in your gut where it's like all jumbly. And then it's like, you know, you have the squiggles and you get the squiggles out. And she's like, I don't know if that's impatience. Could that be excitement? Like she asked, I'm like, oh my God, that's excitement. And then I'm like, I'm going to cry again. She's like, did someone tell you maybe that you were being impatient and to sit still?
Probably.
And so you took that as being, instead of excitement, you took that as being impatience, and you've been labeling your excitement as impatience your whole life.
Yeah. What a big shift, hey? Like that switch. And I know those feelings in therapy when you're like, what are you saying?
She's like, how are you feeling now? I'm like, angry. Like, I'm frustrated. And oh my God, like, how do I have gone through life this long and not realize that that feeling is excitement? And maybe I can go into stuff now with like, oh, I'm excited about this. Not like, I got to get this done.
Yeah.
Because this is impatience. Yeah.
What a shift that's going to make. Like, that's going to feel so good. And you're like going into your next, even maybe your next podcast recording, your next interview or meeting or whatever you're having. And to know that that is a feeling of like, that's a positive feeling as opposed to like, oh, I need to fix that I'm feeling impatient or I'm just like, why can't I get? But now you're like, oh my gosh, I'm excited for this opportunity. I'm excited to meet this person. I'm excited for whatever it is that you're doing.
Yeah.
That'll be such a shift in your mindset. That's amazing.
Yeah. We were talking about this thing about how emotions frame time and how like there's physical things that frame time. So like what I called when we were talking about anchors. So for instance, like I have lunch every day at 12. It's an anchor point in time. So I understand the passing of time because I have time blindness. Instead of exercising when you get up, exercise is at 8. It gives you like, and then you can frame time like, oh, this is the passing of time. Just give you frame. But you can also use emotion as cues, or like a cue to start work could be like, oh, I feel excited when I really want to do this. Mm-hmm. Or I'm starting to feel irritable. Oh, I missed my snack break. And so it can help you. You can use things to help you with framing time, because to me, time is like non-existent. And I said, it's like being on a ship in a rough sea. That's how I feel like most of my days are. To people who may be neurotypical or not have this issue with time, time is like a lineup of dominoes. And so you can see the dominoes going into the future. Mine is like, the way I see time is like a stack of blocks that go up versus out. Mm. And so I see everything at one time.
All the things you have to do.
Which is why it's Yeah, which is why it's overwhelming, because it's like everything everywhere all at once, literally, is the
great name for that movie.
True. So we don't see things stretching out. We see things all at one time. It's like a big wall.
That totally makes sense. I can even relate to that. And I don't know if it's, who knows? Yeah, anxiety. Like, it is anxiety for sure. But like, you know, all the things that need to happen. Yeah, it's just, it's very similar. It's like a wall of the things. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm like so excited to do this. What I'm on working on this one film. I'm so excited for this film. And then I'm like, gotta get all these other projects done to get the time to be just on this film. It feels so daunting to get to the one thing that I want to work on. But then the other day I was like, wait, I can just like take this 3 hours and be excited to work on this film for these 3 hours and then do my other things. And that's okay. But I still get to do the film. So it's again, like trying to reframe and trying to be like, I can do it and I can be focused into it for the, I don't have to clear everything off my plate to still be excited and be in this movie. So reframing, that seems to be our theme for today's chat.
Yeah. Understanding what words mean in your body.
Yeah. Another good theme.
Another good lesson thing.
And also therapy. Therapy's great. There's this great company that works out of my office called Timber Benefits. And they've developed this great benefit package for mental health. And so I was chatting with the owner of the company and I was like, they're making it accessible. It's just a really reasonable price. And like if employers get this benefit package and like people can actually utilize therapy for the whole year and like be able to do this like ongoing weekly, bi-weekly therapy sessions. And for me, I know this last year I like did therapy every 2 weeks and it really made a huge, huge difference in my life. And it was like, I didn't realize how big of an impact having that 2 week check-in made until I like took a moment to like stop back and be like, whoa, look at how far I've come. I've just been able to have somebody to like guide me through different ways of communicating, different ways of thinking, different ways of thinking. So like the idea of having mental health resources be accessible to everyone at an affordable price.
Yep.
So important. And it was just so refreshing to hear that this company, that's like their mandate and that they've worked out this plan and they're like putting it into action. And I'm so proud of them. And I'm so excited for the future of hopefully like more and more companies can do this kind of stuff and allow therapy to be something that everybody gets to have. It's so important.
Agreed.
On that note, thank you for listening to this episode of Brains. Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor. And our theme song is by our little brother, Depish.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and tell your friends to tune in. You can reach us on Instagram, TikTok, or Twitter at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website, brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little more about who we are and what we do. Until next time, I'm your host, Heather.
And I'm your host, Sarah. Bye.
Bye.